Hello, I'm Peter Clote, and this is a special edition of Straight Talk Africa. Yoweri Museveni in his own words. I recently traveled to Uganda, where I had the rare opportunity to do a sit-down interview with President Museveni. The wide-ranging topics included Uganda's commitment to peace, security and stability in Africa, and particularly in East Africa, the coronavirus pandemic, as well as democracy and the rule of law. I also saw reaction from Ugandans who disagree with how the president has ruled the country since coming to power in 1986. Over the two decades, many African countries have embraced presidential term limit in their constitutions as a transition from a one-party state to multi-party democracy. However, in recent years, coups, especially in West Africa, and term limits in East Africa have come under attack from incumbent presidents seeking to extend their tenures. Let's take a look at this VOA report.
Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States, once defined democracy as a system of government, of the people by the people, for the people. But Western-style democracy, as defined by President Lincoln, is being tested across Africa, especially in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. As of April 2022, five African heads of state had been in power for more than three decades. Teodoro Obiang Nguema Basongo, age 79, has been president of Equatorial Guinea since 1979. He is Africa's longest-serving leader. Paul Biya, age 89, has been president of Cameroon since November 1982, and he's the second longest-serving leader on the continent, with nearly 40 years in office. Yoweri Museveni, age 77, the president of Uganda, has been in power since January 1986. Other long-serving leaders include Denis Sassou Nguesso, age 78, president of the Republic of Congo for 34 years. He first served from 1979 to 1992, and then from 1997 to the present. King Mswati III, age 53, is the king of Eswatini, a post he has held since April 1986. He has ruled for over 36 years. The kingdom of Eswatini is the continent's last absolute monarch. Let's take a moment to focus on Uganda. Yoweri Museveni has been elected president for six consecutive terms. The 77-year-old is one of Africa's longest-serving leaders. He won the 2021 election with 5.85 million votes, or 58.6%, while his closest challenger, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine, had 3.48 million votes, or 34.8% of the vote. Uganda's election campaigns are often marked by security forces' crackdowns on opposition candidates and their supporters. Over the years, this action has raised concern about whether these elections were free, fair, and credible. The Ugandan government says it tightens security during election season to ensure a peaceful outcome and unnecessary lawlessness, but critics disagree. In previous elections, opposition leader Kizza Besigye ran against Mr. Museveni four times and lost. What makes Museveni tick? He's hugely popular. He commands a solid following, especially in rural areas. Some people say that if presidential election were held today, he would probably still win. Some analysts have suggested that weak institutions and rubber stamps parliaments make it easier for leaders like Museveni to reject democracy. In December 2017, the Ugandan parliament voted to lift the age limit for the presidency, allowing Museveni to rule indefinitely. He had pushed to change the constitution in 2005 to abolish the term limits. Although President Museveni has presided over strong economic growth, his critics accuse of failing to tackle rampant corruption in the nation of 48 million people. In 2021, Transparency International ranked Uganda 144th out of 180 countries on the Corruption Perception Index. Political analysts say democracy is seriously at risk in Uganda because politicians can no longer trust voters to elect them.
I began my conversation with President Museveni by asking him about Uganda's commitment to peace and security.
We don't want to be flunkies of anybody. Now, as we went along, especially we who were younger, had time now to elaborate more the sentiment into principles. And the principles we evolved were four. Number one, patriotism. You must love Uganda as a whole because you need it. You need it for the prosperity of our people. First of all, because of the market, because Uganda market is good for the producers of goods and services, irrespective of what tribe they come from. So we rejected the line of sectarianism, the tribes, religion. We rejected it. We said this is not serving our interests. Because if I am a cattle keeper like myself, I produce milk, I produce beef. Who are my friends? My friends are the ones who buy the meat and who buy the milk. How will you ensure prosperity? So therefore, principle number one, eventually, although initially it was sentiment, feeling, anger, but when we analyzed more, we found that there were actual reasons, not just sentiment. And number one was patriotism. Love Uganda, down with sectarianism, down with the politics of identity. But then we saw that if the African people wake up and start producing goods and services, even the internal market of Uganda will not be enough if we are really serious. And that's why we say the second principle is Pan-Africanism. You must work for the integration of the whole of Africa. And then the third principle was what we call socio-economic transformation, modernization. Society must go from its pre-capitalist character to a modern middle-class, skilled working-class society. And then finally, democracy. So, when we pushed these lines, we found that we succeeded because they attracted more followership, but also good quality followership, both in quantity and in quality, we were doing well.
So let's talk about trade and Uganda. Some of your officials were attended the summit with regards to the European Union and African Union summit, where they looked at ways where Africa's interest and European interest will be addressed. And some African countries have expressed concern that although there's an agreement, the European market appears not to be open. And that when there are processed products like coffee, cocoa, and all kinds, and processed from Africa, there are some restrictions or taxes put on them. Mm. What is your stance, Mr. President, regarding that?
Well, that's the distortion. That is the distortion. Why do you allow unprocessed coffee? And when I process it, you block it. What are you looking for? What are you saying? That means you are saying that Africa should always only produce raw materials. Don't dare to add value. That's the message. We need to reject that, to point out. Of course, in the short run, we are a bit weak because we are fragmented. We are not one market of Africa, which is huge. I think we are now going to 1.5 billion people. But it's good to state our position on the one hand, and on the other hand, to work on the integration itself of our own market. Because if our market was integrated and acting with one command, then we would discipline those Europeans, because we would be able to say, if you don't do this, we shall not do this. But now we are begging, we are appealing, we are petitioning, because we are still weak on our side. We are not organized. We are not weak, but we are not well organized.
Back to Uganda, would you say your economic policies have taken roots and bearing fruit and improving the lives of Ugandans and, of course, the refugees who are here in Uganda?
If you trace historically, we were the first to acknowledge the role of the private sector when we came into government. And it really helped the economy to grow. The inflation rate is very low. You can check the inflation rate, must be like 2% or 3%, because everything is there, either produced locally or imported. Our push now has got three qualitative elements. Number one, all the homesteads must join the money economy. Number two, aggressive import substitution, because many of these imports from China, from they can produce them here, our people. Number three, import export promotion. But maybe you could also add number four, science-led economy, led by our own scientists. So therefore, the economy will grow much faster and be bigger and more modern.
I want to get your thoughts on the Chinese investing in Africa. Sometimes they provide assistance, aid, with Russia also some military assistance, development loans, investment, military support in countries such as Mali and the CAR. What are your thoughts about these two countries partnering Africans and, you know, with loans and all that?
The politically speaking, from 1917, from 1949, China and Russia have been on the side of the anti-colonial movement. I think these Western people need to be a bit serious. They have been on our side politically. When we defeated the colonies, we have no problem. We Africans forgive and forget. So we decided to stay together, like with us, who were with the British. We are members of the Commonwealth. We have no problem. But for somebody to say, have a problem with China, why are you dealing with China? You don't know why? China was supporting me when you were disturbing me. Have you forgotten?
Mr. President, let's talk about the law in Uganda. Recently, you talked about elections that were held during the pandemic and all. I understand you called on some opposition leaders to meet and all that. My question is President Yoweri Museveni willing to meet your critics and opponents to hash out? Because as you said, it's patriotism and building the country together to talk in a dialogue, to address their concerns as you move the country forward.
We are meeting. We are meeting. We have a group called IPOD. Interparty
Advisory Committee?
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay.
We have some of those, a few who don't come, who don't want to come, that don't attend. Otherwise, we have been having this for the last, almost 10 years now. We have been having this iPod. We discuss everything. Party funding, that's how we got the government to fund political parties, because there was that problem of funding parties because the membership, because of the culture, but also a bit of poverty. The the members don't contribute to the parties. So they were having a problem of funding. And we said the government must fund them following a certain formula according to the numerical strength of the parties in parliament.
So, Mr. President, some of these minor parties, as you call them, are saying that the political space appears to be narrowed and that when they go about meeting their constituents or meeting their supporters, security agencies, including police, are used to stop them. Sometimes they are beaten, sometimes they are dispersed. How do you respond to such criticism, Mr. President?
That's not true. The friction was over the corona time. After they are the ones who caused the second wave. So second wave of corona should be opposition wave. Should call them corona parties. They are the ones who had avoided the second wave. They are the ones who caused it because of indiscipline. If you want to demonstrate, there are free spaces like corona airstrip where we have celebrations. Like you can go there and show whatever you want to show, but without interfering. So that's how we get into some friction. Otherwise, there's no... The radios... Uganda has got one of the freest media in the world. Check how many radio stations are there. They say whatever they want to say. If they break the law, they are accused in court and they fight it out.
So, Mr. President, one of your critics made waves with claims of torture by the military, and that he has the scars to prove it. I think his name is Kakwenja Rukirabashaija and the likes. And they said they had known you to be against torture, but this is happening. So when you hear that, Mr. President, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's true that some of the people were tortured. I have got some, I've not confirmed about that one, but I have confirmed some other cases. And I took it up with the, because you see the part of the problem of Africa is knowing what to do, is capacity building. We are building armies and security forces. These come with, sometimes they come with traditional ideas from the village, or they get imported ideas from the former colonialists. Like for instance, the police force, which was here during the colonial times. They were using those methods of torture to make people talk, to make what. Now, that culture still lingers on, especially in the police, which is an older organization. But from the army, which is new, they come with the village ideas. In the villages, when you steal, you are beaten. This is the traditional way. It is cultural that they beat you for two reasons. First of all, to make you talk. Oh, are you the one who did this? Oh, yes, I'm the one. Please don't beat me. Then also as a punishment now. You have those currents. The answer for those is, apart from the documents are there, the laws are there, but the sensitization, to tell them that first of all, torture is not necessary.
That was Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni speaking with me in Kampala. Now here in the studio is law professor and author Kenneth Mwanda. Kenneth, it's great to have you back on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Peter, and pleasure, as always.
So, Kenneth, you heard the president of Uganda on a wide-ranging topics, but then he spoke about the rule of law. The opposition groups say the political space is narrowed and that security agents are used to suppress them and all that. The problem sometimes becomes the president is proposing campaign at one place, don't go to the market to disrupt business activities. The opposition is saying, but we need to disrupt in order to have our messages cut across. What are your thoughts, Andrew?
You know, in any democracy, even in the Western world, you are bound to have disagreements. The concept of politics, first of all, what is politics? Politics is characterized by conflict. If there's consensus, it's policies, not politics. So naturally, there will be conflict, different sector interests in society. And I'm one who doesn't want to just condemn. I would also like to give credit. I think President Museveni has done some good work in terms of trying to fight the terrorists, especially from the Horn of Africa, terrorist sort of disturbances and so forth. And he's gotten a lot of support from the U.S., funding and so forth to support those initiatives to stop terrorists from the Horn of Africa. So we must give credit there. There are other areas, of course, where one would have some misgivings. For example, the extent to which you tolerate dissenting and opposing views, and also allegations. I call them allegations because they are not yet confirmed, but there are reports that, you know, his approach is quite heavy-handed in terms of how he handles dissenting views, as well as interference in politics in the neighboring region. There have been disagreements between him, I think, and President Kagame, but recently they're sort of trying to, you know, patch fences. And I think the road from Uganda into Rwanda, the border has now been opened, I think, effective right. January. Mm-hmm. So there's some progress there. But I see a lot when I listen to him, I can see the sort of Dar influence. He went to University of Dar es Salaam, mm-hmm. and I think he was taught by people like Walter Rodney from you know, Guyana, who was very leftist. So I could see that if you listen to him, he spoke about the four pillars. One, patriotism. Two, pan-Africanism. Mm-hmm. He came to socio-economic transformation. Then fourth and finally, democracy. That's economic determinism. Very sort of materialist, from a dialectical materialism point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, he's trying to push that frontier. So you can see the Dar influence in him. He's still there.
So Kenneth, yeah. when I asked him about regional security, right. and he mentioned these four elements.
Right.
Now, they recently launched a joint offensive in DRC against ADF rebels. And they are trying to help stop the terrorism activities in Somalia. My question is, has Uganda played a critical role in ensuring the region is politically stable and safe for residents? Because DRC just joined the East Africa Community.
Yeah. I think that's not a very, in my humble view, I have reservations about that approach. There are only three instances in which a country can get itself involved in another country's politics. Sort of, I'm taking the Westphalian model. One is under the UN Security Council collective decision that, you know, let's move in. Secondly is where a country's acting in self-defense, you've been attacked. And thirdly is where you've been invited by the country that is facing aggression to come and help them. There is no other basis in international law. And this is the same thing we are seeing in countries like Ukraine today. Even this argument, there are some countries that have advanced the argument of preemptory self-defense. It's not an existing concept in international law, although some scholars try to justify it, that we are trying to disarm terrorists, and that's why we went in. No. There are only three established grounds in customary international law supported by conventional international law, which is treaty law. UN Security Council, self-defense, and when you're invited in by the country under siege.
Kenneth, looking at Uganda's political stability and security stability at the moment, the opposition groups have said that he has stayed in power for too long. Some argue that since independence,
you've not had a smooth transfer of power from one leader to the next in Uganda. And this is the longest stretch where the country remains peaceful. Your thoughts?
Yeah, President Museveni came to power, I think, 1986. Mm-hmm. And then in, I think, 2005, there was a constitutional amendment to lift... first of all, there was a referendum to open it up to multi-party politics. Mm-hmm. And also there was an amendment, constitutional amendment, that got rid of the two-term limit, leaving it open. Another major milestone was in 2017, another constitutional amendment now to remove the age limit from 75, leaving it just open, because this is about 78, I think, this year. So that allowed him to stand. So we have to look at these issues in perspective. It reminds me a lot of President Kaunda in Zambia. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that discontentment, saying that he had been in power for too long and so forth. And Kaunda was, I think, much less than President Museveni. But yes, the interesting question we need to ask ourselves, the last elections were marred with violence and so forth. But, it shows that he had a landslide victory. Perhaps one would want to find out if it's a slightly marginal win, maybe you could say, but if it's landslide, then you begin to ask yourself, he probably, I would want to believe, has some support, still has some support. Of course, there are people who have different views, and they would like him to stay, but he seems to still have some support and legitimacy within the country.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear more of my interview with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. I will also hear from two Ugandans who disagree with the way he has ruled the country the last 36 years. Stay with us.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Now let's go to the second part of my interview with President Museveni.
So, Mr. President, you talked about CSOs or civil society groups in Uganda not being CSOs, calling them foreign agents. Why do you say so? And I've heard some of them saying that the government seemed to use the institutions such as the security, police, and then the judiciary to clamp down on civil liberties, including free speech and opponents of the administration, who you described as the minority. How do you respond to such, Mr. President?
My understanding of civil society was that I would have my own means of living. I am a farmer, I'm a lawyer, I'm a doctor. That's how I earn a living. But somehow I get a passion for something. For orphans, for something. And I make a contribution there also. But I'm not paid for that. No, even when I raise money is to deal with the disadvantaged people. That's what civil society I had should be. But now, the civil society of Africa, especially here in Uganda, which I know, are these young people who are not employed. Now they are hired by foreign interests, using even government money of foreign governments, to come and agitate for something. So how can you call those civil society? They are employed by external forces.
Mr. President, during the few elections that I have monitored in Uganda, Your opponents say Mr. President has been in power since 1986. What at all does he want to achieve that he hasn't achieved? What does he want to do? Children born since 1986 have known only one leader and one leader only, President Yoweri Museveni. They said it is about time Mr. President goes to his farm, takes care of his grandchildren, and then leave it to the young generation to continue what he has built. How do you respond to them, Mr. President?
Well, I thought those people were Democrats. I thought they were Democrats because that's a decision that is taken by the electorate. The electorate, first of all, the problem we have is that all those actors have no mission. They just want power. Our understanding is the what. What is to be done? Because if you answer the what is to be done, and you look at our four principles, if we have done something on the patriotism, good. That's why we have got some good results. That's why Uganda is not a failed state. That's why we don't have the UN here to guard us, to defend us, or France to bring troops here to defend us as if we are no, there are no people here. So that is an achievement. But how about integration? You remember integration we have. So integration, how about socioeconomic transformation? We have moved, for instance, the literacy rate is 76% now. It used to be 43%. So when they say, what did he want to achieve that he has not achieved? There are so many things that we have not achieved our movement. Like, for instance, the literacy rate now is 76%, but the jobs are not yet enough for all these people, and we are struggling with that. Integration, we are struggling with that. So then, because of that long time mission, we ask the question, if you have got such big issues to deal with, to handle, you have achieved some, others you have not yet achieved, but you aim at them. Is it wise to have, as they say, on the sea, when they are running a ship, all hands on board, everybody in the ship, all the staff come and contribute? Or is it correct to say, although we have not achieved all our aims, some of the actors, you go, we don't need you, because we have been around for too long. For us, we say, please. It is the mission that determines the who. If we reach a stage where we say we don't need all these elders, good, because we have achieved our mission. So that argument is really between the mission-oriented people and other people who just want, I don't know what they want. We don't accept that argument.
Well, Kenneth, you heard the president. He doesn't accept that argument that he stayed in power for too long. The opposition argue that he stayed for too long. He is the third longest African leader, coming after Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo of Equatorial Guinea, and then Paul Biya of Cameroon. President Museveni is the third. Your thoughts on his argument?
Thank you, Peter. I'm going to say two things here. First, I will disagree with him, and secondly, I will agree with him. Let me start with the disagreement. it is not true or valid to argue that he is the only one with a vision for Uganda. You know, there are many other competent Ugandans who can equally carry out whatever he is saying. And I think there's a price to democracy. The majority in parliament are, you know, from his party, the National Resistance Movement, NRM. So, of course, they voted for those constitutional amendments to allow him to continue. That's the price of democracy. The majority take the day. But it's not, in my view, it's not correct to say that he's the only one with that vision. There are many capable Ugandans who can equally carry out that vision, with him or without him. Now, to agree with him, on the other hand, I want to agree that, yes, when you have multi-party politics, there are a lot of opportunists and speculators. Okay, you're going to have somebody who's going to tell you, if you vote me into office at 14 hours, the local currency will pick up. Okay? Someone will come and tell you, if you vote me into power, immediately I'll sell the presidential jet because my predecessor was all over flying. I won't be doing that. But the moment he gets into power, he gets on that jet, he's having a good time. And he'll tell you, well, this is not a priority. I want to talk about other things. Mm. So I sometimes say, you know, on social media, in my commentaries, I said, people are not honest. So we see this a lot in politics. We've had politicians who've said, if you vote me into power, in 90 days, I will deliver X, Y, Z. They are voted into power. Those 90 days came, they changed the argument. So President Museveni is right. You would have a lot of opportunists trying to occupy the space. Okay, but it's up to the electorate, and that's where civic education comes in, to really be able to discern and understand and scrutinize the candidates that are coming before them. Now, the challenge that we have in a lot of African states is that Uganda, for example, has more than 20 political parties. Most of these countries have so many political parties. And you can see, basically, you've got characters who don't even meet the minimum of being a school prefect.
You know, I asked one of the political leaders, if you have one objective, and one objective only, to wrestle power from President Museveni, why don't you come together as opposition leaders and challenge him?
Sometimes what happens is you will find the opposition will get into an alliance of convenience because they've got a common enemy. But as soon as they wrestle power from the incumbent, they win the elections, you begin to see problems start to emerge. It's like, hyenas wrestling the carcass from a lion. After the lion is gone, then they start fighting amongst themselves. We've seen that a lot. And the reason for that is very simple. These are opportunistic policies. They are not based on ideology. If you have a common ideology, it's very easy to remain united. But because you went into it for position and hunger to fill your stomach, so if you're not given a job, you leave the alliance. And this is African politics. That's what it is.
The other part of it is, do these opposition politicians often overpromise? They call them candy men when they are campaigning because they promise everything to everybody, to any place they go to. When they are elected, it's a different ballgame altogether.
Cajoleries is the name of politics, especially in Africa, making false promises. We've seen it over and over. Let me take an example of Zambia. In 1991, when President Kaunda lost elections, he was magnanimous enough to admit that he lost elections. He never held. And by the way, he actually opened up room for elections before his term came to an end. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have never taken that into account. So we must give him credit for having helped Zambia transition. The MMD promised so many things, privatizing and so forth, but the infrastructure really just went down, the economy shrunk. There was a huge cost on the state subsidizing the state enterprises and so forth, and that was a big time of structure adjustment programs and so forth. But really, the infrastructure that Kaunda set up in terms of things like rural development, diversification of the economy, export promotion policies, import substitution, he had those in place. Okay. Now, fast forward, you see this in other countries as well, where people promise so many things when they come to power. And then within a year, people are impatient. They want to see what you promised them. Mm-hmm. Because you said at 14 hours, the local currency will change. You said you're going to sell the presidential jet. You haven't sold it. You're still riding on it. So tell us, what's going on here? What has changed? Because these are things you promised us. You told us, if I appoint my cabinet, wait and see who I'm going to appoint. And they're watching. Is this the best you can give us? That's why sometimes when you make promise, make realistic promises, not just promises for the sake of getting into power.
Thank you very much, Kenneth. We'll come back to you again. Let's go to my discussion with Orie Mieku, a Uganda-based researcher for Human Rights Watch, who talks about President Museveni's human rights record.
So the report is called I Only Need Justice, and it documents unlawful detention by security forces in Uganda. This is something that has been happening for a very long time. We talk about and document security forces, being the police, the military, and other officials arresting people from their workplaces, their homes, and taking them to places, for the most part, that are not authorized by the law for people to be detained at, and holding them for months at end, and subjecting them to a range of different forms of torture, including beatings, including having electric currents applied to their skin, and as well as sexual violence, including rape. And our report talks about how those things happen, but also what the experiences of people who went through these experiences and have now returned and have now been released, what they are going through now. And what we found was that they face a number of challenges, especially in obtaining justice.
But Oriem, the official government position is that torture is not a policy of the government.
Yeah. Well, the president has said that he doesn't condone torture. Other high-ranking officials have said that these acts are committed by rogue officials. They may say that, and they have said that for a long time, but the fact remains that security officials that are affiliated with the Ugandan government have been committing these abuses for a very long time. Our report, you know, documents cases from 2018 up to late 2021, but this has been happening for very many years. I think that if the government really doesn't condone these abuses, then they should end them immediately today. They should stop today, but they haven't. And I think that reflects on the fact that actually, in a lot of ways, the government does condone torture.
President Museveni told VOA recently in an interview that torture doesn't work, and that he has been trying hard to explain to some of the employees in the police that they should not torture people, and that he has a dossier of investigations going on to punish the perpetrators and all that. Why don't you think this is enough to try, as part of the effort, to limit or stop torture in Uganda?
Well, first of all, it's not enough to just say it's wrong or that it shouldn't happen. We have to see real consequences. When people commit torture, when people arbitrarily arrest individuals, when people are unlawfully detained, which is illegal in Ugandan law and in international law, we have to see that the things that are supposed to happen, that is people actually being held accountable, being prosecuted for these abuses, we need to see that actually happen. And that has not been the case in Uganda. There's been little to no accountability for hundreds and hundreds of cases of these abductions and disappearances and torture. And I think that's the reason why it's just hot air, because we haven't seen the actual consequences for these abuses.
Is Human Rights Watch going to engage the government about this report, as well as probably the Human Rights Commission in Uganda, designated by the Constitution to ensure the protection and respect of human rights in the country?
We have engaged the government. We've drawn attention to this report. We've had several meetings with government officials. We also invited them to the launch of the report today. Unfortunately, we didn't have an opportunity to hear from them today, but we will continue to engage with them as we continue to advocate for the justice needs of the victims that we document in the report.
That was Oriem Nyeko, a Uganda-based researcher for Human Rights Watch. Now, Kenneth, you've heard Oriem Nyeko. He works for the Human Rights Watch. They come up with a yearly report about the protection of human rights, or the respect of human rights in Uganda. And he forced the government that the government isn't doing enough. The government says we are doing enough, we are disciplining people, we are investigating. The president himself told me that he has a dossier, like you saw in the interview, of people that he's trying to have his people investigate, and then perhaps the perpetrators punished. Your thoughts?
It's very common, those type of scenarios in many parts of the world. Let me take a recent one because there were two major elections last year in Africa, in southern Eastern Africa, the Zambia one and the Uganda one, very similar parallels. One of the reasons why PF government lost power is that there was a lot of indiscipline. You had all these cadres who were misbehaving, mistreating people, you know, all sorts of stuff. There was no discipline, okay? And so people were disenfranchised. People were not happy about that. So ultimately, it was a protest vote. Mm-hmm. There was corruption, which was not being addressed, okay? So discipline is a very important thing, especially in leadership. You can be a very nice leader, a very nice person as a gentleman, but you must, as a leader, provide discipline to the machinery and to the state systems. There was no discipline under PF, so they lost. It was a protest vote, okay? So this is exactly what you're seeing in Uganda. Eventually, people get tired, and you can't stop it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a revolution. They've got the power of the ballot. Even if you try to rig elections, if they are just overwhelmingly frustrated, like happened in Zambia, you're going to lose.
But Kenneth, some NRM supporters I spoke with in Uganda,
yeah,
were telling me that some of these politicians purposely, right, try to create disaffection, sometimes threaten national security on TV with rhetoric that are unbecoming, they said. But the supporters of the opposition group say this is a free country. The Constitution guarantees freedom of speech and expression, so we can say what we want to say. But how far do we go? So it's like a ping pong, pretty much.
One thing that President Museveni understands very well, and I give him credit for that, he understands the politics and how to work around them. There are two elements that help you win legitimacy and stay in power. Use of force, which he seems to be heavy-handed, or use of ideology, propaganda, mm-hmm, and so forth. We didn't attack Ukraine. They're just telling lies. You know, you want to drum up that propaganda. So how you use ideology or how you use power, force, or you can use both. So that has really helped him. But like I said, it can only go to a certain extent. From a Marxist point of view, once the contradiction between the forces of production and the relations of production hit the peak, the revolution comes in.
You know, I was surprised when I went to parts of the country outside Kampala.
Right.
And I saw the opposition gaining some momentum.
Right.
But then the president still has a lot of support there, too. I was pleasantly surprised, yes, because I thought, from what reports we've been hearing,
right,
that a president is really unpopular in other, right, parts of the country, but it looks like it's a 50-50 now.
The interesting part is that when you talk to intellectuals or middle class, you know, these are guys, some of them don't even vote, okay? They are drinking whiskey at the golf club and so forth. Okay, these are not the usual voters, you know, so you have to understand the constituency that comprises the majority of the voters, rural women, you know, the uneducated and so forth, the poor people. Those are the guys who are going to be in the queues waiting to vote, okay? But there does come a time when even the intellectuals join the movement. They're just fed up, okay? And that's what we saw, for example, in Zambia recently. You know, everybody sort of moved in. So, yes, it's true that sometimes you can have rhetoric coming from people who are not even voters, and that really doesn't count. And I think President Museveni is very astute to some... If you look at his history, he was, you know, a military sort of general, mm-hmm, fought in the Liberation War. He understands the psychology and the psyche of the masses and how it's working. But that can only hold for so long, not forever.
36 long years. All right, Kenneth. Yeah. Sarah Birite is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Governance, a civil society group in Uganda. She disagrees with President Museveni's assertion that civil society groups in the East African country are agents of wealthy Western nations who are seeking to take advantage of Uganda's weaknesses.
For a while now, President Museveni and his government have been calling civil society as agents of change. It's a targeted blackmail, and the state bases on the source of funding, which CSOs use through diplomatic missions and other corporations that are in partnership with the government of Uganda as well as the people of Uganda. It is important to note that our current budget is more than half of our current budget is funded by donors. The same donors that fund both our recurrent budget and 100% of our development budget are the same partners that work with civil society organizations in Uganda. But the regime uses the narrative because civil society gets funding from the same partners that they get their funding to blackmail civil society and put them against the people as if they pursue foreign agenda or objectives that they are not registered to do by the same government that he heads.
Now, Basera, some NRM supporters that I spoke with are of the view that if you are real civil society groups, then you should be able to fund your own activities. President Museveni pretty much said the same thing. And they believe that some of your activities seek to undermine the territorial integrity of the government of Uganda, basically seeking regime change. Don't you think their concerns are legitimate?
Why can't he first fund his own government? The current budget, recurrent budget, he can only fund 44%. 56 is donor funded. If he heads a poor country where people are impoverished for 36 years and he cannot raise enough tax, fund his own recurrent budget, how can he expect entities whose workers are similarly impoverished to fund their own work? That is the hypocrisy of the highest order.
Sarah, let me ask you about constitutionalism and the rule of law. Recently during the pandemic, opposition groups during the recent general election campaigned in spite of COVID-19 measures. The president was not happy about that because he felt that the actions of the opposition during campaigning basically became a harbinger or a platform to increase the spread of the coronavirus. What is your take on that?
At the beginning of the pandemic, Uganda had three options to take in as far as the 2021 elections were concerned. The first option was to declare a state of emergency and postpone elections. Under that scenario that is provided for under Article 110 of our Constitution, the president would have lost power to the speaker because he cannot extend his mandate beyond 5 years. So he feared that option. The second option would have been to declare a state of emergency and then enact the Elections Emergency Act. That Emergency Act would have provided for clear avenues under which elections would have been conducted in the pandemic. That option was also left alone. So we ran elections under draconian regulations, manufactured under the draconian archaic Public Order Management, Public Health Act that was enacted in the colonial era of 1935. These rules were very twisted and unfair against the opposition in Uganda. The president used the state machinery to meet organized groups funded by the state and campaign in a cordial manner. But we also saw his agents holding rallies in towns, including rallies by musicians that were campaigning for him, which violated COVID regulations. But no security officer shot and killed people in the rallies that were organized by President Museveni's agents. It was an election shrouded by double standards, hypocrisy, and unfairness against the opposition.
That was Sarah Birete, Executive Director at the Center for Constitutional Governance in Uganda. Now, Kenneth, you heard Dr. Sarah Birete. Well, what are your thoughts about her concerns about, you know, being labeled as agent of the West seeking regime change, trying to undermine the territorial integrity of Uganda, among other issues she raised?
Yeah. Thanks, Peter. Like I said, I always look at the pros and cons of every scenario. Mm-hmm. There's no one right answer. In this situation, she has some good valid points. President Museveni also has some valid points. And let me elucidate a little bit. There are NGOs and civil society organizations which are funded to influence change of policy domestically.
Right.
Yeah, that's a known fact. Mm-hmm. Okay. At the same time, we have legitimate CSOs and NGOs who are doing good things on the ground. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we cannot just wholesomely condemn President Museveni. No, that's not right. At the same time, we cannot agree with him wholesomely, but we should be somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. So he's got some points there. And I want to touch on another point that President Museveni made, which is very valid, especially for Africa, the issue of tribe, ethnicity, and sectarian politics. Mm-hmm. This has really messed up our politics on the continent, okay? Nobody, no leader whatsoever will ever agree that their mandate is being pushed on sectarian politics or tribal ethnicity issues. Mm-hmm. You just have to see it. No one, a thief will never tell you that, yes, I'm a thief. You know, you just have to look for the evidence,
right.
Okay? If the evidence is there. And that's a very poor way of governing. You cannot last in power if you begin to project that biasness in society. People can see it, the electorate.
But Kenneth, that is what some are accused of doing by dividing their electorate so they will have a block of their supporters. And some would say, when I come back or when I come to power, you should not expect any development in your area because I know where my votes came from.
You have to be a strategist, not a tactician. A strategy is long-term thinking. You have to look at the demographics, the numbers. Even if you're going to play the politics of tribe, what are the numbers? Can you carry the day at the end of the day in terms of people who are supporting you?
Right.
If you are from a minority group, you're taking a chance. Mm. If you are from a majority group, maybe you can survive, but it's not a good way. Have a nationalist agenda. And this is what we saw with people like the old man, Kenneth Kaunda. Mm-hmm. It was a national
one
agenda.
One nation, one Zambia.
One nation, one Zambia. This is what we saw with people like Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. This is what we saw with people like in Dar es Salaam. What was
Nyerere. Right.
Okay. That type of politics which transcends ethnicity and transcends parochial sort of insular type of thinking, a global perspective, you know. And even in your agenda, your foreign policy has to be well articulated. Don't just focus on dealing with your opposition locally. Okay, Nkrumah in Ghana, mm-hmm. although his domestic policy was troubled, mm-hmm. but his foreign policy was very sound. Mm-hmm. He championed the non-aligned movement with the Kaundas. Mm-hmm. The issue of what's going on between Russia and Ukraine today, for example, what's the position of African states?
They are pretty much on the fence, except a few that, you know.
That's why the issue of non-aligned movement is now, they are trying to revive it.
Right.
You know, because you don't want to get entangled in some of these messes. We saw what happened in DRC in 1961 when Patrice Lumumba was taken out. Mm-hmm. He was hoping the Soviets would support him. But somehow Brussels, London and Washington were not in agreement.
Before we go, Kenneth, briefly, colonial era laws being used by government. I mean, in some parts of Southern Africa, they say the archaic laws, you cannot insult the president, or if you criticize the president and they think you are insulting them, then you go to jail. Briefly, 10 seconds.
The thing is, those who are in the oppositions will always condemn laws which work against them. When they get into power, they will never repeal those laws. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kenneth. Thank you for watching a special edition of Straight Talk Africa on Yoweri Museveni, one of the longest ruling heads of state in Africa. Please follow our conversation on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Peter Clotin. Good evening, Africa.